This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to a Friday night edition of Navarra Live. I'm joined by Aaron Bastani for the second night in a row. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm good, Michael. I think I might need a little bit of a haircut, but I'm very good. Very happy to be joining you for a second consecutive evening. Lots to get through.
I forgot my own name, which is why I jumped to you quite quickly before you'd managed to get your hair done, but hopefully I'll gather my senses as the show goes on. Coming up tonight, newspapers and government advisers are stating that Gaza protests have made London a no-go zone for Jews. We speak to an organiser of the Jewish bloc on those demonstrations. A student at Cambridge University has defaced a painting of Arthur Balfour in protest at the genocidal war going on in Gaza, and we discuss George Galloway's plea to Jeremy Corbyn to join his Workers' Party. Let's go to our first story. Palestinians in Gaza continue to face near famine-level conditions as Israel is refusing to allow sufficient aid into the Strip. And in response, the United States has a new plan. Joe Biden unveiled it at his State of the Union address.
I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
Now, it seems somewhat cynical to stand up at the State of the Union address, which is, you know, to the American public and say, Israel, you need to do X, Y, Z, right? Because if Joe Biden really wanted Israel to do X, Y, Z, in this case, let in a sufficient amount of humanitarian aid into Gaza, he could make it happen tomorrow, right? He'd just pick up the phone and say, if you don't do this, we're going to stop vetoing the resolutions against you in the UN, which the United States keep doing, by the way. You know, a vast majority of the world's countries want to begin holding Israel to account. The US keeps using its veto, right? And now Joe Biden still says, oh, we've asked them nicely, still giving them military aid. So Joe, standing up in front of the American population and say, I'm being tough on Israel, while not using any of the enormous leverage you have over them, is pretty pathetic. And we'll also have more on the rest of the State of the Union address later in the show. He obviously discussed lots of things. Focusing, though, on the plan to build a temporary pier on the Gazan coast. Now, officials have said it could take 30 to 60 days to build, right? So it's not going to provide any immediate respite for Palestinians. Now, it's also been briefed that the Americans would still allow for aid, this time shipped via Cyprus, to be inspected by Israel before delivery. So that would still give Israel a possible role in holding up aid. Now, let's go to a Guardian report for some more details on this and also some of the problems with this. So the Guardian, right, the plan involves US military engineers building a floating pier off the Gaza shore on which shipborne food aid can be unloaded from ships from Larnaca and a causeway for it to be driven on shore. The question is then, what? Most of Gaza's population, most of whom have been displaced several times over, are not concentrated at the beach, right? So you get the food to the beach, they're mostly not on the beach. Who is going to distribute it? Asked Jeremy Kneindick. He's a former senior aid official in the Biden administration and now president of the Refugees International Aid Advocacy Group. So he added this, the aid organization's presence in northern Gaza is pretty close to zero because the Israelis have wanted everyone out and then have been restricting access to the north ever since. So the Guardian write, the proposed maritime aid corridor, Kneindick said, doesn't obviate the problem of obstruction by Israel, but rather than being a problem at the entry point, now it's going to be a problem at the distribution stage. You need drivers that don't exist, trucks that don't exist, feeding into a distribution system that doesn't exist, he added. It's a really, really significant problem. Yes, you might be able to dump all of this food on the beach, but there are 2 million people living in Gaza right now. You want them all to sort of make their way to the beach in a, you know, presumably a very disorganized fashion to try and share out this food, right? That is not how, you know, a properly managed aid network or an aid system works. And the International Rescue Committee, who know a lot about this, right? They're also not impressed by Biden's announcement. So they told Al Jazeera this: Palestinians in Gaza need a sustained ceasefire and they need it now. A temporary pier that could take weeks to construct or airdrops is not a solution. Now, as for airdrops, on Monday's show, we discussed the problem with airdrops of aid by the Americans. And the amount delivered was only small. So on Monday, only a total of 38,000 meals for a population were dropped for, you know, a region where over 2 million people are, where over 2 million people are on the brink of starvation. So it's a drop in the ocean. There was also no plan for distribution, much like with this pier plan. And there's been a grim new development. So Al Jazeera is reporting that 5 Palestinians have now been killed by airdropped aid. The Gazan Health Ministry has said this occurred when the parachutes attached to aid parcels failed. And this footage has been released. And you can just see how chaotic and almost sort of apocalyptic these scenes look, where you've got these very heavy aid packages falling rather quickly from the sky. So you can see how that's incredibly dangerous for anyone there who's desperately, you know, trying to get their hands on these food parcels because they and their family are starving. So really, really dystopian. All this means the airdrops of aid and the floating port seem more like dangerous gimmicks than any genuine attempt to help Palestinians. But Britain has been keen to show it's on board with the port idea. And this was Foreign Secretary David Cameron speaking today.
We've been involved in this maritime corridor from the start because what it's going to do is take aid from Cyprus in the Mediterranean and directly into Gaza. What we've been doing is helping with the pre-screening of aid. So you check it in Cyprus so it doesn't have to be rechecked when it arrives. That's important. We also had the Royal Auxiliary ship Lime Bay delivering aid from Cyprus right at the start. But this new idea from the President of the United States, which we're involved in, of building a temporary harbour in Gaza means that aid will be able to go directly from Cyprus to Gaza. But it's going to take time to build. So the crucial thing is today the Israelis must confirm that they'll open the port at Ashdod. That is in Israel, but that's a working port. It could take aid now. That would increase the amount of aid, and that aid can then be driven into Gaza. That would make a real difference, and we need to make a real difference right now.
Was it another very frustrating scene, I think, of a Western politician saying, Israel needs to do this, Israel needs to do that, while still supporting Israel in all kind of material senses. Right? If, for example, our government was arming Russia, and then we had politicians go out and say, oh, Russia needs to stop invading Ukraine, right? No one would take that seriously, right? Because you're arming them. So to see these Western politicians, Joe Biden, David Cameron, saying, Israel needs to be better to the Palestinians, do something about it then, right? As for the suggestion there, so Cameron seemed to be suggesting that sort of before this floating pontoon is constructed, more food could be got into Gaza via Israel. So you'd send it from Cyprus to a port in Israel and then it would get driven into Gaza. Now, this is slightly odd because it's Israel who have been blocking aid until now, right? So there has been no sort of geographical reason why aid can't get into Gaza. It's because Israel is blocking it. So the idea that now it will go to an Israeli port and then into Gaza seems somewhat bizarre. Now, if we were to be, I suppose, sympathetic to him, look to, you know, where the sense might be in this idea, it might be the case that he thinks it would be harder for Israel to say no to transferring it when the UK and US can say, we've already checked this. You know, there haven't been any intermediaries. Whereas with these aid organizations in Egypt, or, you know, their trucks are based in Egypt at the moment, I think Israel has sort of said, we don't trust you to do these vets. So maybe it'd be harder for them to say that to the Americans and the Brits. Aaron, you know, whatever is the case there, this all seems pitiful, really, doesn't it?
I mean, you've just shown a collection of clips there which look ridiculous. I don't think America has ever looked more ridiculous. You know, it's looked impotent. It's looked defeated. You can think of the Iraq War, withdrawal from Afghanistan. But it's never looked this ridiculous. Bear in mind, there's emergency measures going through Congress right now, the United States wants to give Israel $19 billion in aid. That's a package for both Israel and Ukraine. It's being held up at the moment because of misgivings around Ukraine, not Israel. There is some criticism coming from the likes of Bernie Sanders, but generally speaking, the criticism of that foreign aid to foreign countries is the aid going towards Ukraine. $19 billion being given to Israel. Given the size of Israel's economy, that's a hell of a lot of money. It would be the equivalent of this country getting more than $100 billion from the United States. They cannot prosecute this war without aid from America. They cannot prosecute this war without weapons from America. Israel was the first country in the world in 2018 to use an F-35 in combat. So it is very much a tier one ally of the United States. And the US public, the American voter, is not an idiot, right? And I know people like to paint this picture of people that vote for Trump as idiots. And by the way, I don't think the right response to this is vote for Donald Trump, but hear me out. But what Trump says, or what populists generally say, actually, about overseas aid, is really captured here. So on the one hand, you're selling the weapons to a country, a client, to flatten somewhere else. You know, I think something like 70% of buildings in northern Gaza, Michael, you know the data better than I do, have been heavily damaged as a result of Israeli strikes, military operations, and so on. They're destroying these buildings. You're giving them the weapons to do that. You're literally funding it, and then you're going to pay for something to be built to feed people who are being starved as a result of a military operation which you're helping, which you're enabling and assisting. It is completely insane. And by the way, you talked about that temporary pier port being built might take 30 to 60 days. Who's to say that won't be bombed, right? The whole point of Gaza is that it's isolated. It has no airports. It has no ports. You don't want things getting in. That's been Israel's strategy for a very long time. Why wouldn't that be destroyed? And so, you know, the median American voter says, well, hang on. We're using American taxpayer money to fund Israel. We're using American taxpayer money to build this stuff to deal with Israel destroying Palestine. And by the way, in the reconstruction of Palestine, who do you think is going to pay for that? You think it's going to be Israel? Of course it's not. There'll be some global, multinational, multilateral, you know, conference in somewhere nice like Vienna or Oslo, maybe New York. And you'll have people like Cameron and Blinken, and they'll say, we are so wonderful in the West. We will give tens of billions to the reconstruction of Gaza. Just stop it being flattened by your allies who you're giving money to, right? I mean, I know I sound like I'm saying some very simple things here, but that's literally the level that we should be operating at. And you have this phony, nonsensical proposal from Biden. Crazy proposal, given what's happening and what I just said. And of course, literally within hours, of course, David Cameron, well, yeah, of course, we'll partner with that. You know, it doesn't matter what the United States says. Whatever they do say, Britain will follow, because British foreign policy is not made by people in this country. It's set by Washington. It's set by the US president, the Oval Office, the Secretary of State, their equivalent of foreign secretary. We don't make foreign policy in this country. So British taxpayer money is going to also go towards this project, which, like I say, it could be destroyed. It'll go towards the reconstruction. And then you get Tory voters or people on the right generally who say, well, foreign aid's a waste of money. Well, here, you're absolutely right. Now, clearly, money should be spent on helping Palestinians. Of course it should be. But the immediate necessary task should be stopping the war in the first place.
It's sort of like the tobacco industry subsidizing, you know, cancer screening equipment for the NHS. It's all like, just stop selling the goddamn cigarettes. On airports, you might be wondering, oh, does Gaza have an airport? It did have an airport. It opened in 1998. It was called the Yasser Arafat International Airport. It is no longer open because in 2001, Israel bombed it. So they bombed it. It doesn't have a runway. That's why you can't get a plane to Gaza. They have a very small fishing port, but Israel hasn't allowed it to be expanded beyond, you know, capacity to have some fishing boats, right? So you can't bring in aid via a fishing port. Aaron, I suppose I want to, your history is better than mine. And it does seem to me that there's something a bit unprecedented here, which is a country airdropping aid because their own ally is stopping it entering by other means. So I remember from, I don't know if it was my GCSEs or my A-levels, but I remember we did the Berlin airdrop. So that was in the late 40s or early 50s. And that was when Now, the USSR tried to block off West Berlin from the rest of Germany because you know, they were upset at the current, you know, the state of the deal. And then the Americans at that time did quite a high profile airdrop campaign into West Berlin. So they say, you're blocking the roads, but we're going to stand with our free people in West Berlin and drop lots of aid. Now, that made sense because the US and the USSR were, you know, rivals, enemies, right? This was the Americans saying, we've been forced to airdrop because of these sinister communist Soviets, but we will rise to the challenge. Whereas now they're being forced to airdrop aid, or they're airdropping aid because their own ally, who they're funding, won't let in aid by conventional means. Obviously, you know, we've just said five people have been killed by this aid falling from the sky. This is really an absolute last resort. And I don't know, Aaron, can you think of any other sort of historical circumstance where a country has been forced to airdrop aid because their own ally won't let it come in via land?
Top of my head, I can't. I mean, obviously, there's been many ridiculous incidents of similar things. So, you know, the occupation of Iraq after 2003, the Allies, the US, the UK, various other countries destroy Iraqi infrastructure, and then they pretend as if they, you know, care so much. We're working night and day to get the generators up, the clean drinking water, blah, blah. Hey, maybe just don't destroy it in the first place. But in terms of an ally or an allied state being this central, like Israel, I can't think of any examples. Certainly not when you think about the asymmetry of the two countries, right? The United States, 350 million people, the world's leading economy, military power, is having to base its actions around what an allied state of a population with, 10 million people is determining. The United States by population is about 35 times bigger than Israel. And it's basically being told what to do and how to conduct humanitarian aid. Now, if it matters so much to you, Joe Biden, you know, why are you playing by the rules given to you, dictated to you by Tel Aviv and Jerusalem? So it is pretty unique. I mean, I don't like to say things are unprecedented because invariably with our dummy foreign policy in the West, very little is actually unprecedented. But in this particular regard, I think it might just be.
As we said earlier, so all of the sort of humanitarian organizations, they're saying this is all a bit meaningless. What we need is a ceasefire. There is no way that we can sort of get our aid infrastructure up and running until we get one. Now, on the prospects of a ceasefire, David Cameron said this today.
I think there is the chance for ceasefire, but it requires Hamas, who should have released the hostages, in my view, already, but it needs them to sign up to the deal that Israel has agreed to release prisoners in their jails in return for hostage release. Hamas should sign that today. Then we could have that pause for 45 days or maybe even longer and use that pause to build momentum for a permanent, sustainable ceasefire without a return to fighting. We all want to see this terrible fighting stop, and that would be the best way to make it happen. But it is for Hamas to make that decision, and they should do that today.
You've seen this sort of subtle shift between Western politicians saying, oh no, we can't have a ceasefire because that would freeze the conflict as it is. We need Israel to have the chance to destroy Hamas. And now they're saying, oh no, we do want a ceasefire, but Hamas is the one blocking it, right? Now, the problem with saying the responsibility for a ceasefire lies with Hamas is that Israel has still not renounced their war aim of completely destroying Hamas, right? So agree to a pause in fighting, release all the hostages, which is your only leverage, and then we will still destroy you, right? It's not a realistic offer to make. You can't, you know, if in a sort of hostage situation, right? You've all watched those sort of American action movies. If the hostage negotiator says, release the hostages and then we're going to kill you all, you know, the hostage takers aren't going to release the hostages. You know, it's not a genuine offer. Until Israel can put something forward which is a bit more meaningful than release the hostages, we'll stop bombing for a few weeks and then we're going to completely destroy you, why would they accept that? I'm not saying whether they should or they shouldn't. I'm just saying we've got to be realistic about how these things work. Aaron, what do you think of this sort of move whereby Western politicians have stopped saying, no, we don't want a ceasefire, and now they've said, we do want a ceasefire, but it's Hamas that's stopping us getting it?
Well, it's nonsense, Michael. It's obviously ridiculous. But the point is, they're having to change their rhetoric because of changed facts on the ground. When you have 30,000 plus people die, 10,000 plus children die, when you see war crimes, inarguably, I think, when you see ethnic cleansing, inarguably, I think, genocide has a higher threshold to meet, but I think it's that as well. You see emaciated children, you see babies dying in ICUs because of a lack of electricity within hours of being born. I mean, sheer depravity. Even somebody like David Cameron has to tell himself, well, I'm not okay with this. So it's Hamas. And let's be clear, it is not a ceasefire to say, okay, we'll stop fighting for a couple of weeks, give us what we want, and then we asymmetrically will start fighting again. That's not a ceasefire. That is not a ceasefire in any meaningful sense. You know, okay, we will stop basically attacking civilian populations, which is why I say it's a war crime. It's collective punishment against civilians. That's happening. We will stop the war crimes, give us everything we want, and then we'll stop the war crimes again. That's not a ceasefire to any sensible person who's thought about it. Also, in terms of change in tack, Michael, you know, you had the State of the Union with Joe Biden a little bit earlier, and he said, look, the solution here is peace and a two-state solution. Well, guess what, Uncle Joe? The Israeli government overtly is saying it rejects a two-state solution. Overtly. Now, there are illegal settlements going into the West Bank every single day. People are dying in the West Bank. And of course, this attack came from Gaza. So it has absolutely no connection to a, you know, quote-unquote response to October 7th. People were being killed in the West Bank before October 7th. They're being killed now. It's not governed by Hamas. It's governed by the Palestinian Authority. So none of this is coherent. I mean, obviously, the people watching and listening to this, they knew that. But I think it is notable that people like Biden, Cameron are having to shift to saying things that they weren't overtly saying several months ago. And, you know, look, okay, Joe Biden, you support a two-state solution. The Israeli government does not. You're on a collision path with regards to how do you solve this. Right now, Israel is inflicting war, you know, they're guilty of war crimes. They're killing tens of thousands of civilians as an act of collective punishment. And you don't agree with how it's solved. What next? And the best they're doing, Michael, is to basically talk about a US taxpayer-funded pontoon, and they're dropping aid on people and it's killing them. Because there's, you know, the whole thing's just a complete disaster. It's being delivered catastrophically. Not really a surprise, given Israel isn't being, you know, accommodating. So I think it does show you something about Western politicians, even people not especially sympathetic to Palestinian cause, probably don't even care that much about, you know, popular backlash initially with regards to how Israel is conducting its operations. I think now they think, well, look, if the next 5 months are like the last 5 months, this is going to go down in history as a genocide. It is. Because you start to look at 5% plus of the population being killed, 5% of the population who are civilians being killed, this will be what I am remembered for. And I think that's certainly true, by the way. This carries on for another 5 months like it has the last 5 months. Joe Biden will absolutely be remembered as, you know, Genocide Joe. That's not some flippant talking point that I'm going to say on Twitter. You know, I genuinely think that. What we're seeing right now as a conflict is unprecedented, I believe, in undermining some of the values that the West claims to uphold. Now, you can talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, and of course, they were awful. They should never have happened. They were illegal. Tony Blair should be, you know, in The Hague for that. But I think this is different in so much as we are just seeing a brazen genocidal intent from Israel, I think. You know, when you see the images of the people that have been run over by tanks, I said this last night, right? Hold that in counterpoint to the scenes from Tiananmen Square in the late 1980s, early 1990s. We're told this is the, you know, the definitive image of protest dissent. Well, look, Israel, they don't stop the tank when you stand in front of them as the brave protester. They handcuff you to the tank and they drive over you until you're squashed. And I think something quite significant is happening right now in terms of how Western decision makers want to be remembered, what kinds of, you know, decisions they're making, and maybe even, you know, morality is at play here too. I think when you start seeing so many emaciated children dying, hey, even for David Cameron, something might click.
I do wonder if that's why there's sort of all this discursive focus on humanitarian aid, because it was, we reported on this, or we showed you last night, this really powerful, horrific report actually from CNN, with sort of emaciated kids who went on to die of starvation. And those were the scenes where sort of emotionally, I felt, wow, this does look like a genocide, right? Because obviously, you know, the scenes before, I've listened very carefully to the arguments from the International Court of Justice, very compelling argument that this is a genocidal war. But, you know, we've seen scenes of sort of war and the bombing of civilians before in Iraq, in Afghanistan, many places, in Ukraine, right? But the fact of a country just forcing a famine on its neighbor, you know, intentionally. It looked very sort of emotionally genocidal. And I think that sort of Western politicians know that. And now that's why they're talking about these sort of nonsense PR stunts like floating pontoons. Next story. Joe Biden has given the last State of the Union address of his first term in office. The speech is given annually by American presidents to both houses of Congress, and it's broadcast on all the major news networks. So this time was seen as a significant opportunity for Joe Biden to try to begin to rescue his ailing re-election campaign. Now, unsurprisingly, he spent a lot of time attacking Donald Trump.
When a Republican president named Ronald Reagan thundered, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Now, my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, "Do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable. I say this to Congress, we have to stand up to Putin. Send me a bipartisan national security bill. History is literally watching. History is watching. If the United States walks away, it will put Ukraine at risk. Europe is at risk. The free world will be at risk, emboldening others to do what they wish to do us harm. My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win.
You saw in the background Kamala Harris and then sort of a leading Republican, the leading Republican, sort of these subtle shakings of his head all the time. It did look sort of in the crowd, very, very, the Democrats were clapping all the time and the Republicans were just very, very stony-faced, never stood up. You could see it's sort of a very highly polarized situation. In the speech, Biden highlighted his commitment to defending abortion rights against Republican attacks. That served the Democrats very well in the midterms because the Republican position on abortion is not popular. Another Republican position which isn't popular is their refusal or their opposition to banning automatic assault weapons, so the kind of weapons that are used in many of these mass shooter events. So Biden wanted to sort of make an issue out of that, quite rightly, let's be frank. He also had some fairly progressive things to say about the economy.
Folks, the Affordable Care Act, the old Obamacare, it's still a very big deal. Over 100 million of you can no longer be denied health insurance because of pre-existing condition. But my predecessor and many in this chamber want to take this prescription drug away by repealing the Affordable Care Act. I'm not going to let that happen. We stopped you 50 times before and we'll stop you again. Many of my friends on the other side of the aisle want to put Social Security on the chopping block. If anyone here tries to cut Social Security, Medicare, or raise the retirement age, I will stop you. The working people who built this country pay more into Social Security than millionaires and billionaires do. It's not fair. We have two ways to go. Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. That's the proposal. Oh no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share.
The speech seems to have been considered a success, basically because Joe Biden seemed quite energetic, very responsive to the crowd, didn't trip up on many of his lines. So that was sort of, you know, a fiery speech from Joe Biden, which most people seems to have thought, you know, it's not going to rescue the campaign. People are still worried about his age. There's still lots of people very rightly, understandably, outraged by his position on Gaza. But in terms of sort of this vision now that's sort of been painted of him as this doddering old man that's completely incompetent, I think he stood up there and, you know, he gave a decent performance. Interesting as well that, you know, you'll know if you watch this show, we are completely outraged by Joe Biden's position when it comes to Gaza. On the economy, though, he's sounding more progressive than the Labour Party in the UK. Now, historically, the idea that the Democratic Party in the United States is to the left of the Labour Party in the UK is very unusual, but at least rhetorically on the economy, they do seem to be right now. You can see there as well what Joe Biden wants to fight the next election on. So this idea of sort of democracy, they tried to steal the previous election. And then on the economy, because you'll remember when Donald Trump got elected the first time, he did try to get rid of Obamacare, but he didn't manage it because John McCain refused to vote for the proposal to abolish it. Now, what the Democrats are going to be saying is that if Trump wins next time, and if he also wins, you know, both chambers of the House, then Obamacare will be gone. So they're going to be trying to say the stakes are really high here. And that was his attempt to sort of start to begin making that argument. What about the Republicans then? So Alabama's Katie Britt is the youngest woman representing the Republicans in the US Senate. And she was chosen to give the Republican response to the State of the Union address. And which, interestingly, she delivered from her kitchen table.
I never could have imagined what my story would entail. To think about what the American dream can do across just one generation, in just one lifetime. It's truly breathtaking. But right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare for so many families. The true, unvarnished state of our union begins and ends with this. Our families are hurting. Our country can do better. And you don't have to look any further than the crisis at our southern border to see it. President Biden inherited the most secure border of all time. But minutes after taking office, he suspended all deportations. He halted construction of the border wall, and he announced a plan to give amnesty to millions. We know that President Biden didn't just create this border crisis. He invited it with 94 executive actions in his first 100 days.
It was an incredibly hammy video. She was overacting, I think, somewhat. It looked like a bit of an audition tape for like the Disney Channel or something. Showed two things, I think, seriously. So the very shrill tone of American political debate, it was almost sort of apocalyptic. She's talking this huge smile about the American dream and now we're all going to hell. The other thing that I think we can take from that, the extent to which the Republicans will use the US-Mexico border as an election issue in this campaign. Now, that's possible in part, of course, because of fear-mongering from news channels like Fox, but also because border crossings have actually dramatically increased under Joe Biden's presidency. So between 2010 and 2020, there was only 1 year when apprehensions on the southern border exceeded 500,000 people. Under Joe Biden, every year has seen more than 1.5 million people apprehended. And in the past 2 years, the number has exceeded 2 million. So this is one of those issues where, you know, whether or not you agree with it, you know, it's not completely fabricated as something that's changed under Joe Biden. Not all of Donald Trump's attacks on Biden have been data-led, though. Trump posted a video on his official Instagram page during Biden's State of the Union address, which used a bunch of filters to give Biden and Kamala Harris bulging eyes to dress them. I think this is sort of Mexican farmers, and then there's another which made Joe Biden into a cartoon rat. Aaron, the State of the Union address and then the Republican response to it, have we learned anything significant about the presidential election? I should say, actually, this week also we had Super Tuesday, and so it's been pretty much confirmed that it will be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump because Nikki Haley withdrew. So what can we expect from Donald Trump versus Joe Biden? What do we know this week that we didn't know last week?
Well, first things first, Michael, that wasn't a cartoon rat. That was a hairless chihuahua. Maybe a Mexican cholo, but I think it was a hairless chihuahua. Secondly, I mean, that lady, what's her name again? Katie Britt. Wow. Michael, I know British politics has got some problems, but there's some real freaks in the US, right? She's saying, I am, you know, the embodiment of the American dream, but the American dream has become a nightmare. You're only 42. How does that make sense? When did it become a nightmare? You know, you're a young politician. And the way she's talking, you think she's, you know, she's set up her own business. She came from nothing. She came from destitution. And she was raised in a middle-class household. She had, you know, both her parents there. They had a small business. She went and studied political science. She became, guess what, Michael? A lobbyist. And now she works in government. I mean, that's not the American, that's the American nightmare. Get a real job. Don't become a lobbyist. Get a real job. And it's interesting that, you know, this is essentially somebody who's a career politician. She was in law briefly. And when I say she was in law, she was working in law / current affairs. But these are career politicians who try and talk in the register of 30, 40, 50 years ago, but that country has gone. And so they have to rally against this insulated political elite. And this is both sides of the Atlantic. You're a part of that insulated political elite. You know, you were on a conveyor belt from university into Washington and the Washington establishment. So what a strange woman, very strange messaging. And I have to say, in contrast, that Joe Biden seemed actually quite normal. I'm in no way endorsing his policy on Gaza or 101 issues, frankly. I think he is too old to be the president of the United States. That's not ageist. It's simply one of the most demanding jobs imaginable. He's 80 years old. I think I would struggle, you would struggle with a job like that. Maybe not you, Michael, you're a bit younger. But even for somebody in their 20s, it's incredibly onerous, sleep deprivation, lots of travel, huge anxiety, you know, high stakes, obviously. And, you know, I think age can be an asset, but I think at a certain point, it's going to be really hard for you. It's certainly going to be hard for him campaigning. So I'm not suggesting he's, you know, the ideal candidate for the Democrats, but hold him in contrast to Katie Britt, and my goodness, it's chalk and cheese. Trump on Instagram, it just seems childish. If you're laughing at that, you're probably going to vote for the guy. I don't think any sort of independent voter would look at that and think, okay, this is a really serious guy who's going to sort out this country's problems. It might not put them off either, but it just really spoke to me about how unserious Trump is as a politician. But like you say, the issue of the border is a very real one, and it's something that the Republicans are going to mobilize to undermine and attack Joe Biden. And that is the main thing here. You know, we can talk about Katie Britt or Trump, but it's that kind of policy which is going to get Trump over the line. I have to say, though, you know, it's such a hard election, Michael. I'd love to know your thoughts on this, and of course, our audience too. Some days I think, my God, it's going to be a blowout for Trump, you know? You look at some of the polling in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and you think, wow, this could be worse than 2016, actually. I think Biden's going to win the popular vote, but I mean the Electoral College, of course, and that's what matters. It could be a real blowout. It could be 1984-style Reagan Dukakis, you know, just a sea of red. But then there are other times, and I saw Katie Britt there, and I see Biden, I think, I mean, you know, maybe it'll be like 2000. He'll get over the line. But I think not. You know, if I had to bet on it, I'd bet on a second Trump presidency. Because in 2020, obviously COVID massively to the advantage of an anti-incumbent, but also Joe Biden, his Achilles heel is campaigning because he's just not necessarily there, you know, cognitively and physically. And that played to his advantage. But I think actually having to be on the road, glad handing, you know, talking to so many people, so many opportunities for bloopers and mishaps. I think that's maybe where he comes unstuck. It's still a long time to go. You know, he may not be the Democratic candidate in November. So I don't know, Michael. It really, this ambiguity for me, is it a Trump blowout or does Biden get over the line? I wasn't sure yesterday and I'm still not sure.
I'm still very much not sure. I suppose in terms of some accountability, I remember me and you having a conversation about this like a year ago. And back then I was, you know, feeling quite positive about Biden's chances. And that's because I was like, you know, in 2016, Trump won because he was talking, you know, he was still a crazy guy, still, you know, very obnoxious, racist. He'd been, you know, that tape had come out, the Access Hollywood one, still, you know, a very, very bizarre candidate. But he was talking about some issues that people actually cared about. So sort of jobs going to China and migration. Yeah, people do care about it. And I had been saying that I don't think Trump's next candidacy will be a success because the guy can't stop talking about elections being stolen and sort of various issues that ordinary people don't actually really care about. I think what I underestimated was the extent to which he would find an issue to mobilize around. And he has found this sort of border issue, which many people in America do care about. So yeah, I would not want to place bets on the presidential election at this point in time. I mean, if I were forced to do, I think it probably will be another Trump presidency. But I'm not going to place a bet because it would be too, I don't want to be betting on Trump winning. So I'm going to stay very much out of this one, and we will continue to sort of report it with an open mind. Well, not an open mind as to who should win. I absolutely think Donald Trump is the worst candidate, but an open mind as to what may or may not happen. Next story. As an Israeli-made famine in Gaza looms, the moral panic against pro-Palestinian protesters is ramping up a level in the UK. On Tuesday, the Evening Standard devoted a full front page to what it called London's anti-Semitism shame. The subheading reads, "Stark warning, Jewish families plan to flee capital amid rising tide of hatred." The story was based on a report from the right-wing campaign against anti-Semitism group. They cited the pro-ceasefire Gaza marches as one of the reasons Jewish people were apparently living in fear. The Telegraph has a similar headline on Friday. They led with a quote from Britain's counter-extremism czar saying that Gaza protests have meant that London is now a no-go zone for Jews. The anti-extremism czar is Britain's commissioner for countering extremism. He's called Robin Simcox. He previously worked at the neoconservative think tank, the Henry Jackson Society, and the right-wing Heritage Foundation. So it's no surprise he's decided to smear pro-Palestine protesters. But his narrative is being pushed by people high up in the charity sector. The Community Security Trust is a charity whose stated purpose is to provide safety, security, and advice to the Jewish community in the UK. Their chief executive, Mark Gardner, spoke to Radio 4.
I don't go into town when there's these demonstrations. My family and friends don't go into town when there are these demonstrations. We collected evidence with London Jewish Forum and submitted it to the mayor's office, submitted it to the Metropolitan Police. We had dozens and dozens of replies within the space of about 2.5 hours. We had to actually tell people to stop sending us their statements again and again and again. Just people saying, I'm not going into town at the weekend because of these demonstrations. I don't want to be trapped on the underground with these people. I don't want to see them marching. I don't want the risk that they realise that I'm Jewish and start shouting abuse at me, etc., etc.
Have people actually experienced that abuse?
Yeah, of course they have. If you speak up, you know, we hear all about the right of the protesters to demonstrate, but God forbid anybody should say anything against them. Then you'll find out about your freedom of speech and just how much they adhere to that principle.
What about the idea, and we've heard this from people on the marches, that there are thousands of Jews attending the protests?
Well, there are two types of Jews who attend the protests in the main. Firstly, you have ultra-Orthodox Jews who believe that the state of Israel prevents the Messiah from coming. Then you have revolutionary socialist Jews who are there as revolutionary socialists, using their Jewishness so that people get the impression that this movement is not fundamentally anti-Semitic. Now, the problem here is...
How can you be sure of that?
Because those are the banners that they march under.
So there are two types of Jewish people that go on Gaza demonstrations: very religious ultra-Orthodox Jews and revolutionary socialists who use their Jewishness to make the protests seem less anti-Semitic. Emily Hilton is UK Director of Diaspora Alliance, a co-founder of NAMOD, British Jews Against Occupation, and she also organises the Jewish bloc for the London ceasefire marches. I asked her what she made of Mark Gardner's comments.
Mark Gardner's comments are appalling and really show how there is a clear attempt by some of these communal establishment organizations to suggest that the Jewish people who are turning up week in, week out on marches for a ceasefire, who are organizing our community to take a stand against Israel's brutal assault on Gaza, are somehow lesser Jews. And this is obviously a very pernicious strategy to delegitimize the voice of us and of our communities and the people who are taking to the streets every week. In a moment, we're actually seeing unprecedented numbers of Jewish people taking a stand for Palestine. This is part of this broader, it's concerning because it sort of shows how these organizations are kind of aligning themselves with this government, our current government's attempts to really repress not only our rights to protest in general, but also specifically around Palestinian human rights advocacy. And I just find that to be completely immoral. And needs to be challenged at every opportunity. And it's really concerning the ways in which we've seen so many different media outlets over the last week or so really sort of lean into this sort of mass hysteria and fear-mongering that Jewish people are not safe in the UK because of support for Palestine. This simply isn't true. We are able to fight anti-Semitism alongside standing up for Palestinian human rights, and we have to reject that false binary that keeps being shoved down our throats by the media and these right-wing voices.
And how representative of Jews in Britain in general do you think Mark Gardner's comments are? Do you think sort of his attitude towards Jews on these marches is shared by many in Britain's wider Jewish community?
I think there's a clear strategy taking place with an alignment between far-right groups, our very authoritarian political leaders in this moment, to use the issue of anti-Semitism to try and shut down or repress either our rights to protest and specifically advocacy around Palestinian human rights and solidarity with Palestinian people in this moment. I think that there are, this has been a very difficult time for a lot of Jewish people in the UK. Obviously, we do see this rise of anti-Semitism alongside a rise in Islamophobia as well. And there are clearly, bad faith actors trying to create a situation in which there is sort of mass hysteria around the level of threat that these marches allegedly pose. When we know, given that there have been up to thousands of Jewish people turning up every week to march peacefully without having any problem, that a lot of this hysteria is manufactured as a way to justify repressing or shutting down Palestinian solidarity at this crucial time, when we know over 30,000 people have been killed. So, whilst I think that, there is a lot of distress in the community in this time, and obviously, there's a large swathe of the community who are very pro-Israel and might find these marches uncomfortable, I think the majority of Jewish people in this country do not believe that we are under such a threat that we have to leave. Most Jewish people in this country do not think that we're living through Nazi Germany again. These offensive comparisons are just about stirring up fear and allowing the government to therefore justify not only its ongoing support for Israel in its assault on Gaza, but also to justify the sort of shutting down of avenues for protest, avenues for advocacy, for positions that the government doesn't agree with. It's completely terrifying and deeply frustrating to watch.
I would say these are extreme positions, like this gentleman from the CST, but obviously they're not really extreme in the sense that they're being sort of spouted from these very establishment institutions which are close to the government. So we can't call them fringe. But let's say they are, they're at one end of the spectrum. You might get sort of more moderate people, I suppose you could put that sort of in quotes, who say, yes, this language about people wanting to flee Britain or not being able to go into London, that is over the top. But there is still a big problem of anti-Semitism on these marches. They do make Jewish people feel uncomfortable. We need to land somewhere in the middle whereby we, police the marches a little bit more strictly in terms of what chants people are using, whilst, not slandering all 500,000 people, on the largest demo as anti-Semites. I mean, how would you respond to that? And I suppose if you could speak also to, I think you said earlier, you haven't had a single problem on these marches. Could you talk to sort of both of those points?
Obviously, there have been some anti-Semitic signs and slogans and these sort of isolated incidences, but it is a minority of people. And much like how I wouldn't want everyone to judge all Jewish people by Itamar Ben-Gvir, I don't think we should judge these marches on the basis of a few horrible people that aren't reflective of the broader messages and the broader sort of nature of these demonstrations, which is about standing up for human rights and ceasefire and standing up for, you know, Palestinian human rights in Gaza. Like, that is very, very important for us to remember. You know, and I think that, you know, obviously there are, I think there is obviously a lot of concern and there is division around whether these marches are potentially fueling anti-Semitism. I personally don't believe that's true. You know, as we said that, you know, there are thousands of Jewish people going to these marches every week. And I actually think on the whole, there is, you know, there is a few, there are a few loud people in the public eye who like to say the community thinks this, or this is how people are feeling. But I actually think the majority of Jews in this country, whilst might have some discomfort around the sort of the pro-Palestine demonstrations, because in many senses, you know, there is a public media narrative and in some areas of our community, a communal narrative that, you know, Palestinian freedom or Palestinian solidarity is in some way a threat to Jewish people. And that's where we see the conflation of support for Palestine with anti-Semitism or criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And that's what we have to be challenging in this moment. But like, it's also important to say that, like, that doesn't mean we shouldn't not take anti-Semitism seriously. You know, that this is a serious issue. But what we have to make sure we don't do is pit like Jewish safety as being in competition with advocacy for Palestinian human rights. Like, that doesn't help anyone. It is part of this divide and rule politics that we see our politicians pushing in this moment. And that has to be resisted.
So in terms of being someone who's sort of organizing the Jewish bloc on some of these marches, you organize with Nomad, so Jews Against the Occupation. I suppose I wanted to ask you sort of practically how organizing during this period has been. Have you found, for example, that there are people among the Jewish community who might have, you know, before this war, been more positive to Israel, now seeing, well, the brutality of this means I have to go out and demand a ceasefire? Do you see people's minds changing within the Jewish community due to the nature of this war?
I think what I've been very humbled by and reassured by in this moment, actually, is the number of Jewish people turning out. And really willing to actually take a stand against what Israel is doing in Gaza. You know, I think obviously there's been building blocks of that over the last sort of 5 or 6 years. And obviously historically, there's always been sort of the Jewish socialist group and sort of these pockets. But it feels in this moment, there's a much more cohesive and clear message that is coming through that, you know, we can marry our desire to be our full Jewish selves alongside standing up for injustice wherever it happens, including when Israel is committing crimes of humanity against Palestinians. And that is sometimes a message that was often, I think, maybe sometimes harder for people to be able to reconcile because of the way in which Israel can play such a central part of Jewish identity. But this, you know, I think this moment has really shown like the necessity of really taking a stand in this time. And we've been, you know, we do have thousands of people coming to the Jewish bloc. When Nahmad does demonstrations, we have hundreds, if not thousands of people turning up to that too, including people who are not always, who we hadn't been reaching prior to this time. So I do feel like there's a lot of hope there. But of course, you know, there is still a huge amount of work to do. And, you know, there's always definitely a balance between how much we should be thinking about what is the Jewish position in this moment versus making sure that we are not taking up too much space away from also Palestinians and Palestinian organizing in this time as well. So it's a careful balance that I think is very important for Jewish groups to be basically having in this moment. I think in particular because often when, you know, conversations, particularly I think in the media in this country, when you have a conversation about Israel-Palestine, it often sort of gets distracted into a conversation about Jewish community or definitions of Zionism or anti-Semitism. And actually, like, part of the work we have to do is to make sure that we can keep the focus now on what we are seeing in Gaza, demanding a ceasefire, you know, releasing the hostages and a long-term future that ensures justice and equality for all people.
That was Nahmad co-founder Emily Hilton speaking to me earlier today. On to our next story. Whatever you think of the man, George Galloway's victory in the recent Rochdale by-election was a jolt to Britain's political establishment. And in a recent interview, he discussed the possibility of an alliance with another political outsider, Jeremy Corbyn.
I haven't spoken to him for many years, personally. I speak to people who speak to him, and he speaks to people who speak to me, but I haven't spoken to him in many years. So I don't know why he has procrastinated so long in making a final total break with Labour and leading something himself. If he was here now, I would say to him, you saw what happened last night. Set up, announce an alliance of the remaining socialists in the country. You lead it. I'll support it. You be the leader. And let's go. Time is running out. The general election might be 3 months from now. And I wish I knew why he had procrastinated, because if he left Labour at the moment that he should have, at the peak of his powers, he'd have taken a couple of 100,000 people with him. And that's a force. You know, not many parties in Europe have a force like that. He could have led it. And he must avoid being a wasting asset. He is a very considerable asset. And everyone loves him. But he should be careful that he doesn't waste the remaining opportunity that exists. If he won't, then we will. We'll run ourselves. We'll support independence where we don't run ourselves. And we'll do that. But we'll be weaker because of the absence of Jeremy Corbyn at the head of it.
Now, on that plea from Galloway, Corbyn's spokesperson has reportedly declined to comment, but Sky News have reported these quotes from allies of the former Labour leader. So a former aide says this: Galloway wants Jeremy to be the leader of some new great movement, but I don't think Jeremy would do that. He doesn't need Galloway's baggage. George and Jeremy may have spoken at the same rallies during the Iraq War, but they have not ever been close comrades. George Galloway is a lone wolf. It's how he operates. Sky spoke to another source who branded the idea of Corbyn joining Galloway's party as a complete non-starter and said, quote, they may agree over Gaza, but they have totally different politics. It wouldn't be in Jeremy's interests. Aaron, what do you make of this? I mean, I think, you know, most people expect Jeremy Corbyn to stand in Islington North. People have been sort of speculating, should he form a new party? Should he form a new party with George Galloway? What do you think?
If you're going to say that it's a non-starter or it's ridiculous or they share nothing in common, I think you should say that on the record. I don't like people speaking off the record like that. You're giving credibility to a statement, former Corbyn aide, put your name on it. That's my view. Sometimes you can't if you're a whistleblower. This isn't that. So I just don't see how that's especially helpful. You know, George Galloway wrote a book called I'm Not the Only One in the early 2000s. Has many funny anecdotes in it, including the fact that he gave revolutionary literature to Tariq Aziz, the then Iraqi prime minister, shortly before the American invasion of Iraq, so that he could successfully prosecute a revolutionary war. There's some stuff out, you know, you think, well, if that was out there, that's pretty remarkable. He gave the president, the prime minister of Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Mao Zedong and Ernesto Che Guevara, you know, tips and hints how to defend his country. Look, I say that book, by the way, because in the acknowledgements there, and I think in the dedication, it mentions Jeremy Corbyn, you know, amongst other people, as a comrade. So maybe things have changed, but they were certainly close in 2005-06. and I think Jeremy Corbyn should comment on this rather than aides. I find this just distasteful, frankly. Doesn't mean you have to like George Galloway or agree with everything he says, but if you're going to poo-poo a political alliance of any kind between different parliamentarians, I think you should put your name to it. And that's just good politics, good practice. Jeremy Corbyn never wanted to lead the Labour Party. So the idea that he would lead another political party, I think is for the birds. Personally, I might be wrong. I've never had him tell me that. But he was a very reluctant leader of the Labour Party. He doesn't want to be a leader. He doesn't like leading. One could even argue he's not very good at leading. He's very good at making the moral case for socialism. He's an amazing campaigner. He's an amazing constituency MP. And of course, he tried to integrate that into his brand of leadership, right? Sometimes successfully, like 2017, sometimes not. But he is not somebody who wants to lead a political party. So I think that is certainly a non-starter. The idea of him being in the same political party as Galloway, I mean, they were from 1987 to 2005. You know, that's quite a long time, isn't it? That's 18 years. So, you know, there's lots of beef post-respect, the political party which Galloway was a prominent member of in response to the illegal war in Iraq after 2003. There's lots of beef and animosity and bad blood between people on the left as a result. But the idea that they can't be in the same party is obviously nonsensical because it was true in the past. I think Galloway is an extraordinary campaigner. Where I do agree with that comment given is that Galloway is a little bit of a lone wolf. You know, he's not been involved in a political party and collective action in a meaningful sense since he left Labour. You know, he was the only member of parliament for Respect. He won that seat in the 2005 general election. He then won the Bradford West by-election later on, not as a member of Respect. And of course, more recently as an MP for the Workers' Party of Great Britain, he's now the MP for Rochdale. An extraordinary set of accomplishments, but the fact he's not been involved in a larger organisation for a particularly long period of time probably suggests he's not the right kind of personality to work with other people, compromise with other people, to enact the kind of thing he's describing there. So they're both not especially good candidates to lead a new party of the left for very different reasons. They both have their own skills. I mean, my God, anybody who says Galloway is, you know, an idiot, a moron, you do not win. You do not win a parliamentary seat three times when you aren't standing for one of the two major parties, or indeed, you know, the two and a half parties in England. Let's include the Lib Dems too. You know, I said this on a previous show, Michael. George Galloway is one of only two MPs to represent four constituencies. You know, the other one is Churchill, who did five. It's very, very rare. So I don't want to diminish his achievements, but him and Corbyn in the same party, Corbyn leading it, not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I agree it's not happening. We could debate the merits for a very long time, but we've got one more story to get through. A final story of the evening. Targeting paintings is a protest tactic associated with Just Stop Oil. But an activist from the group Palestine Action has done a protest which is even more dramatic. This is, or was, a historic painting of Lord Balfour in Trinity College, University of Cambridge. Now, I said that was more dramatic than the Just Stop Oil protest because Just Stop Oil usually only pretended to damage paintings, right? So they would usually throw paint or sometimes soup on a historic painting, but they wouldn't damage it because they'd normally be sort of in a museum or somewhere where the painting was already covered in protective glass. So it's sort of a stunt, but the thing could ultimately be cleaned off. This Palestine Action activist, I mean, as you can see there, has actually destroyed a painting. And that's prompted a big debate on social media about protest strategy, which, to be honest, I want to avoid wading into now because it can be a bit of a minefield. Instead, I thought we could add value by talking about Lord Balfour. So, Aaron, who was Lord Balfour? Why might a pro-Palestine activist be targeting a painting of him?
So Lord Balfour was a conservative politician at the start of the 20th century. In 1917, he's the author of something called the Balfour Declaration. He was then the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, the Foreign Secretary. And the Balfour Declaration is really the beginning of the State of Israel. It's a one-sentence declaration. It's a very long sentence, it's a paragraph, but it's one sentence. And it says that Britain is committed to a homeland for Jewish people, a Jewish homeland. He talks about people who are not Jewish people who presently inhabit that land. He does not refer to them as Palestinians or Arabs. He does talk about Palestine, but not Palestinians. So effectively, it was a commitment made by the British government to the creation of a homeland for Jewish people. Effectively, political buy-in to the project of Zionism, like I say, in 1917. Now, why does that matter? Because, of course, this is 1917. The State of Israel doesn't exist until 1948. The mid-1940s is when it really gets going after the Second World War. So why is it important? Well, in 1922, Britain is given management of what's then called Palestine. The mandate is given to it by the League of Nations, the predecessor to the UN. So Britain is in charge of what was then Palestine. It has to manage that territory. And effectively, the Balfour Declaration of 1917 forms the basis of its mandate in Palestine. So it's now effectively administering this territory, which it accepts is the legitimate homeland for the Jewish people. You have, like I say, in that declaration from 1917, this admission of other people living there, but they're not mentioned. It's never talked about as a homeland for Palestinians, only as a homeland for Jewish people. Bear in mind at this point, I think in 1917, something like 94% of the people living in that land were Arabs, but they're just an afterthought. There is also a less famous document from 1919 where Balfour says, well, look, there are 700,000 Arabs living in Palestine, but frankly, they're much less important than the idea of creating a homeland for Jewish people in accordance with the political project of Zionism. I mean, these are not my words. He says that. This is an ancient land which belongs to these people. They deserve it more than the people presently living there. That's what he says in 1919. And of course, this is all being talked about and discussed in an age of empires. And it's being discussed and overseen by the largest empire in human history. In the 1920s, Britain actually administered the British Empire at its biggest, covered around 24% of the planet's surface, the British Empire at that point. And of course, they didn't really think that the British Empire was going to end anytime soon. I mean, actually, right into the 1930s, they thought it would be, lasting for several hundred years. So the idea of a viable, independent state for the Arabs who lived in Palestine was just unthinkable for them. But the idea of a homeland for Jewish people, whether or not it'd be a sovereign state, wasn't unthinkable. So Balfour really, he is letting off the starting gun, Michael, for what becomes Israel after the mid-1940s. He gives us the legal basis, the political basis. After 1917, the big four, the four great powers, as they're called at the time, I think it's France, the British Empire, the French Empire, the United States, and the Russians at that point, I think they basically all acknowledge that there is a legitimate claim for Jewish people in, at that point, Palestine. So, the British sort of foreign policy decision here sets the broader foreign policy architecture of, okay, well, this piece of land, which still at that point had very few Jewish people living on it in 1917, this piece of land really belongs to Jewish people more than the people who presently live there. And like I say, by 1922, that has really strong implications. And then all the way through to 1945, the end of the Second World War, it is really the foundation for what then becomes the State of Israel, which of course is founded upon ethnic cleansing, Plan Dalet, the Nakba, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs being forced out of their homes. This all begins with the Balfour Declaration, which of course explains why this person is so angry at this person and why they destroyed the painting of him.
Aaron, thank you so much. I was working out how we were going to cover this story and decided, there's so many sort of endless debates about, is this the right protest tactic? Is that the right protest tactic? Obviously, there is a genocide, a war going on. So does that make destroying a painting justified? I didn't want to wade into it because frankly, you don't really need any extra information to make up your mind. So you can make up your mind yourselves and whether or not you think that was a good idea. But Aaron, I wanted to, give our audience the opportunity to learn a bit about Lord Balfour, and you did an excellent job there. Thank you so much for joining me all evening.
I'm very happy to have joined you. Michael, we love having opinions, but also sometimes it's just good to give people information they didn't previously have. I hope everyone watching has a great weekend, and those listening too. Always fun to do a show with you, Michael, but two in two nights was a real treat.
What a privilege. How lucky we are. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Do come back on Monday. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.